The Ask LA podcast is brought to you by the American Society of Landscape Architects. Produced by the ASLA Emerging Professionals Committee, each episode is geared to provide information and insight into the profession of landscape architecture for students and emerging professionals.
In this episode of Ask LA, we continue with part two of our conversation with Gina Ford, founding partner of Agency Landscape and Planning. This episode originally aired on Facebook Live where the audience asked questions. I'm your host, Daniel Martin. Let's dive in.
Can you speak to the direction you see landscape architecture going within the cities, maybe in terms of sustainability, density, multimodal design, etc.? Thank you.
Where do I see landscape architecture going in cities? I mean, all of the things that you mentioned, I do think that a lot of the work that I'm doing and a lot of the work that I want to do has been about resiliency and resilience planning, and I do see more opportunity there. One of the things that I love doing also is citywide parks plans. This is a big part of the practice we're cultivating here at Agency. And it's really interesting to me that resiliency and environmental change is happening in every major part and city in the country, right? I mean, no one's immune from it. Some communities are coastal and are having sea level rise issues. Some communities are riverine and having riverine flooding. Some are having drought, like we're working on Denver's parks master plan, and just water is such a precious resource there. And so, you know, this notion that every city, despite its where it sits, has some major issue that needs to be addressed in terms of climate change is super interesting. And adapting landscapes for that kind of change is super interesting as well. The only other thing I would say, and then I've done a lot of work on this in the past 18 months, especially since the election of 2016, has been the importance of public space in cities. Oh, sorry, it's noisy here. For democratic action, for protest and civic action. And so I did a TED talk about this. I did some writing back to Martha Stewart, like multiple platforms, really thinking about how important, especially today, our public realm is for this idea of democracy in action, and how important it is that we safeguard those spaces as spaces in our cities, as places of political unrest, as of discourse, cultural discourse, and so that's the other major thing I've been thinking a lot about.
A lot of work going on there.
Yeah. Sorry, is it noisy?
No problem. All right. Okay. Our next question is actually a perfect segue into where I wanted to go with this. This comes from Land 8. Go Land 8. Gina, what were some major considerations and lessons learned from making the decision to go from working at a prestigious firm to starting your own venture?
Yeah, such a good question. I'll start by saying I am so crazy about Sasaki. I'm just so grateful to it, and I love it so much, and it was such a hard decision to leave what was an extraordinary place for me. And I mean that on all levels, for his history and legacy and for this incredible staff and talent that's there, the leadership team that I adore, and it was a really, really wonderful place. It is a wonderful place, and it's a thriving place, and it was a really weird moment in a thriving practice, in a thriving company, to make this decision to leave. But, you know, I think the way I like to think about it is that 2016 for me was a really transformational year in a lot of fronts. It was the year I saw Hamilton and New York City and Beyonce do her Lemonade tour. And I thought at the time, this was a really important conversation about race in America that just was so profoundly earth-shaking for me. And it sounds really trivial, and I know white feminists like having a revelation about race this late in my life, but both of those pieces are major works of art that really say something about the state of our country. I also spoke at the LAF summit that year and talked about environmental change and social equity and collaboration as being these major drivers. I didn't understand at the time when I gave that talk, which was just 10 minutes long, that I was actually laying out a platform of a new kind of practice. DeSantis. And then the national election happened, and we saw sort of that as someone who, again, was a feminist, who was excited about a woman president, and particularly that woman, potential woman president. And what we've seen since then around our profession and the role of climate change and all of these things I really deeply care about, I just felt like I needed to do something that really positioned my work more deeply in that realm, in those realms of race and culture and equity and resilience. And so as much as I could have done that and continue to do that at Sasaki, I just thought this was a more efficient and effective way to do it. And I really wanted to be a woman-run practice. Just to me, that felt super important in this cultural moment in time. And so I did this really crazy thing to leave a really great situation, but I really believe that I want to create a different kind of practice, and this was the best way to do it. So those were some of the considerations, and I could talk forever about this, but that's the high level.
Yeah.
The cultural moment that had to be taken in my mind. So.
Right. And don't forget, in 2016, you also did your first ASLA Ask Me Anything event. That was that.
And that just shook the ground beneath my feet, Daniel.
Great. Thank you for that plug. That'll be in our next commercial. So what did you decided to do something, make the move, start the practice? Mm-hmm. What did that look like? What was involved?
What was involved was, I'll start with, it was about 2 years of hand-wringing, and I just think it's important to note that the decision to leave Sasaki was something that I was talking about very openly with folks there. So it was not a light decision or something that I entered into so alone. I was having a really long conversation about it. And then when I finally did make the decision, probably mid-year last year, it involved planning for a new company, which, you know, is a whole, like, full-time job. And so did a lot of planning through the end of last year, left at the end of December, and started this new practice, which we call Agency Landscape and Planning, with my partner, Bree, who's in the next room doing a conference call. She's an urban planner, and she and I have done work together for over a decade. And she was a partner at Sasaki as well. So she too was making a tough decision to tie her wagon to me, poor thing. And we have our first employee, Rhiannon Sinclair, who's also in the next room. And so, you know, everything that comes along with starting a small business, you know, payroll, capital investment, office space, infrastructure, buying my first laptop, and frankly, it's been really a wonderful and empowering experience. At Sasaki, I was always just sort of, you know, just the design, strategic design leader on projects. I didn't get too deeply involved in business, although I was on the executive committee for some time and did quite a bit of learning on that job. But this is very, like, hands-on. It's like a treadmill. It's like always going. You're just kind of trying to stay on board. So, yeah.
And what's the most exciting and conversing? Conversely, the most scary thing about being in this new position?
I think I have a lot of faith in myself and my team. I believe we're going to be successful. I don't worry about that. I do just, like, worry about sustainable growth and how do we kind of create a business model that lets us be the right size to do the right kind of work. We have lots of things in the works around that. We have, like, strategic partnerships and collaborative potentials that we're exploring that I think are really rich. I think it was a really weird moment to wake up in the new year and not get in my car and go somewhere. I just go sit at my coffee table and work, but also kind of thrilling in its own way. And so, And I think one of the things when we decided to leave Sasaki and start this practice, we very much accepted that we would maybe not have any work for a while and that we would just have to accept that it would take a while. And we've been blessed to have actually three really significant projects either come with us or start since we left. And so now we're in this uncomfortable position. We thought we would be sort of like scrapping for work, and instead we're like just trying to get work done, you know, just like working around the clock, just trying to get the work done. And so we're in a really good position, and I feel really grateful about that.
Yeah. And then 20 or 30 years, when you look back, what would you like to see that would make you feel like it was a success, like your dream came true?
I have this idea about agency, and we kind of describe it a little bit on our website. It's agencylp.com, landscape planning. And We have a collaboration tab, which when you link on it, has pictures of some of our favorite collaborators. When we started this practice, we had this idea that we wouldn't be kind of a traditional hierarchical prime on projects, that we might do that sometimes, but that we wanted to have on our, we wanted to be part of this network of diverse and innovative urbanists and thinkers across all kinds of different diverse expertise. It's this network idea. And so, you know, I really want this to be a different kind of practice, and we already see it in action. We have all these practices we're used to working with that are interesting, deep experts or really diverse, interesting thinkers. And we really want to think about this practice differently, that it's a little less hierarchical. I like to think about it in my mind, Daniel, this is going to sound really crazy, but like if the Women's March was a business, you know, this like group of people that are collectively making action with some loose affiliation around an idea about a vision or a mission, that really just do this extraordinary thing, like sort of just in the coming together. And so in 20 years time, I really hope that we have actually sort of like created a new business model, and that we've actually maybe made some other practices. And I would love it if they were minority led practices more successful because of that collaboration. That to me would be like a real win.
It's awesome. Well, I'm very excited for you and the new venture. I think I look forward to watching how it progresses over the years and what you do with it.
Me too.
Exciting stuff. All right, I'm going to grab a couple more audience questions here. And those of you that are watching, keep those questions coming, because we still have some time to get through quite a few more. All right, question from Emily. Hi, Gina. I'm curious about how you balance right brain and left brain tasks and your creative process to maximize success in what you do, and how your daily experience as a landscape architect has changed from beginning landscape designer to project manager to principal.
I think a lot of the work that I do, because it's complex urban projects and a lot of times is really data driven or science driven, and I mean that if it's planning or design, I think that there's always the need to sort of balance the right and left brain pieces. I think that ideally those two parts of your brain are sort of feeding each other. And so some of the things that I'm most proud of in the work that I've done is really work where the science and data inspires a creative idea, and the creative idea makes something that's really rich and rewarding for the science. So the floating wetlands, for instance, at Chicago, which were this idea about creating fish habitat that could float in the river, really came out of a scientific experiment that was being done by the Friends of the Chicago River prior to our getting there. And we just expanded that and made it into a bigger system. And, you know, we took something that was really just based on biology and made it into something that was far more design rich. And I think that's sort of the cycle that I love. And so in citywide parks planning too, a lot of times we're thinking about data, you know, equity and how needs are being met and how well needs are being met across different demographics with population change, climate change. And so again, that's really fuel for a creative process about trying to meet community needs. I would say that in the course of my professional life, going from a staff landscape architect to a project manager to a principal, it's really like a lot of letting go of a lot of holding on really tight to authorship and control, and sort of letting go of it a little bit and making it a broader process. You know, when you're a staff landscape architect, you're just focused on a task at hand. It's totally your task. You own all of it. It's all about getting that task done. And when you're a project manager, you have to learn how to then delegate those tasks and how to create a process where people understand what they need to do and sort of manage it. And when you're a principal, really, you're sort of overseeing multiple projects at that level, and also just trying to continually kind of inspire and think about the strategy of projects. And so, but at each level, it's really a struggle, because you're only one person, right? And you have so much you need to do. You have to let go of a lot. You know, you have to let go of not knowing every detail about a project, but really knowing the essence of it and really understanding what you're after and always defending that that kind of highest level. Whereas this, I remember when I was staff landscape architect working with Stu, we'd go on a client visit. I was expected to know exactly how many parking spots there were, exactly how many square footage of X, Y, Z benches, blah, blah, blah. And so I couldn't tell you that on most of my projects now, but I can tell you sort of like what we're after philosophically, and that all of those parking spots and benches will get us there. So.
All right. You mentioned several times, this has come up, the Chicago Riverfront project. Is that your favorite project you've worked on of all time?
Well, there's no favorites, Daniel. They're like children. You love them all differently. Chicago was just, it's so new to be opened. It opened, its final phase opened really just this last year. And it was 10 years of work or 8 years of work. So it's the biggest project I've ever been part of. And it's, to me, a miracle, just a miracle of a project, a blessing that it was realized at such a high level. And it met sort of a lot of our goals for what we wanted the design to achieve, which a lot of times you don't have happen despite your best efforts. So, but I have lots of beautiful projects. Right now I'm working on the Highline Canal in Denver, and that's a 71-mile-long canal system. And that project to me is also like a miracle. It's a miracle and an extraordinary blessing to work in a landscape like that that touches all of these different communities around Denver that has these intense kind of drought and environmental change issues and has a climate that's really ambitious about its future. So that might be my new favorite project.
Landscape architects lead the planning, design, and stewardship of healthy, equitable, safe, and resilient environments. The mission of the American Society of Landscape Architects is to advance landscape architecture through advocacy, communication, education, and fellowship. Representing more than 15,000 members, ASLA is the collective voice of the profession. Membership matters. Find out more and join today at ASLA.org.
So if all the projects are children and you love them all, which one would you maybe want to send off to military boarding school?
Oh, no. I mean... I really don't thrive on projects where I don't feel like there's a public served. You know, I think that I've done a lot of developer work and private client work, and I would do it again. I probably would work with many developers as long as there was this notion of the public being served by it. For me, I think really it just comes down to wanting to do things that are truly public and an expression of public good and common good. And so that's not to say those other projects aren't necessary or wonderful. And honestly, they probably offer a lot more opportunity to use better materials and to, you know, have better budgets and all that good stuff. But my heart's really in this idea of public good.
All right. We've got a question from Austin. This was an interesting one, but I think you're going to really like it. Okay. You suggested this on Twitter, and it made me curious to hear the answer. Have you ever gone down a deep internet rabbit hole researching the hotel lobby in The Shining? If so, why?
Someone read my tweet. I love, first of all, who sent that? Was there a name?
Austin Bauman.
Bauman?
Yeah.
So I tested to see if anyone still uses Twitter, and apparently they do. That's good to know. Every lecture I give at a university, I always ask students if they do Twitter, and like they never do. And so I'm like, why am I still on Twitter? Why am I doing this? Apparently they're all on Instagram and Snapchat, but I'm glad someone still is. I like really love Stephen King like deeply. I think Stephen King's like the Shakespeare of our day. I know that sounds really crazy, but his books are insane. Like, and there was a period in my life I read every single one of them. And The Shining always, The Shining and also The Stand are the two that really like speak to me the most. They're just like these like epic stories. And so I was staying once at the Boulderado Hotel in downtown Boulder, Colorado. And it was a creepy night. It was cold. And I was like, you know, I bet Stanley Kubrick like stayed in this hotel and this has something to do with The Shining Hotel. Cause you know, and then I learned that The Shining isn't one hotel. It's actually like a hotel made of all different hotel parts from all of these different hotels that Stanley Kubrick stayed in. So one in Colorado, one in Portland, Oregon, one in London, like really weird. So it kept me up. My fear of being this creepy night and this internet rabbit hole kept me up all night one night at the Boulderado. So thanks for checking out my Twitter feed. That makes me really happy.
That's great. It truly isn't Ask Me Anything. And very timely. We actually, just yesterday in our office here, had a huge conversation about Stephen King books, and we were going down the whole list of Stephen King books. So it's.
Are you a Stephen King fan, Daniel?
Yeah, I really am.
You have one that you
love? I like the Dark Tower series.
Tells me something about a friend.
All right, let's look at our next question from Loretta. Sort of touches on something we talked about, but let's go ahead and ask it anyway. What are the most technical and soft skills that you think a young professional needs to succeed as a landscape architect?
So I think I handled the soft skills, talked about sort of curiosity and all of that good stuff earlier. I think technically, maybe it's worth talking a little bit about technical rigor. I think that great design, really great design in my mind has a make or break moment, and that moment is design development. And design development also has a make or break moment, which I think is grading. I think we do schematic design grading, and then I think when we really start getting into grading, that's where projects really, in my mind, succeed or fail. And a lot of times I see young landscape architects getting really obsessed with the object, like the object in the landscape, whether that's like a seating element or a piece of furniture or a wall, and do that kind of abstract of grading. I think that's just a huge mistake. I think grading is actually like should be the way, the foundation of how you think about design. And so I think mastering how to understand and see great, really well graded spaces and how they were actually designed to be graded, and then see how elements meet grading. Really, you can kind of tell like an amateur landscape from like a master landscape by looking at how well the grading is accounted for. And then I think I was saying that I think that projects succeed and fail in design development, because design development for me always is really where you're starting to put the soul of the project into the work in terms of the material palette. And I think for me, that's always a really exciting moment to really dig deeply into the place and say, like, what does a Raleigh landscape look like that's very different from a landscape in Austin, that's very different from a landscape in Denver, and really looking carefully at what that landscape is made of, how it expresses itself, and how to even most subtle things like stonework and craft, local craft, and again, grading and relationship to bigger landscape systems to me is like super critical. So I think, you know, the more you're a landscape architect, young landscape architect, the more you can get involved in that phase and really pay attention deeply at that phase to how decisions are being made by the principals that are leading your projects, I think the better.
All right. Those technical skills that are important, that are required for young landscape architects coming out of school, looking for jobs at firms like yours or larger firms like Sasaki, do you feel that the schools are meeting those needs that the firms have, that the students are coming out qualified with what they need?
I mean, I think it's a really mixed kind of answer, because different schools provide different things. And I've taught actually at many different schools, at RISD, at Harvard, at a little bit at Northeastern, at University of Nebraska. I've done some visiting stuff at Illinois and Iowa State. So I've seen like every program has its pros and cons, you know, where some are doing more digital representation and fabrication. Others are doing more, still doing hand drawing, but doing really interesting things with hand drawing. Some are a little more heavy on the history and theory. Others are more technical. So I do think that at the end of the day, design is the most important thing that we do. And so I sat on an awards jury a few years ago with McYoung Kim as the chair, and she and I had this really long discussion that was one of the best discussions of my career about the role of design in education and how hard it was as a juror that particular year that so much of what we were seeing was analysis and planning. And we were really like dying to see more physical form making. And so I do think that the more you can take any scale of studio and find some way of expressing physical design in it, don't let it sit at a map scale, don't let it sit at an analysis scale, even if it's designing some piece of a drawing that actually makes something a more of a design expression. I think that's one of those things that I would just focus on as students. I just wanted to give a shout out to McYoung. This is her piece, like, right. Okay. Can't even do it.
That's great.
And you know, I just love that she's like dogged about every project having a beautiful physical form, regardless of what scale it's at, regardless of if it's a drawing or a place.
Oh. All right. We've got a couple more questions. We're less than 10 minutes out, so we'll just keep moving along here. Mr. Advocacy himself, Jonathan Giels, has asked.
Hi, Jonathan. I know you.
He says, would love for you to discuss more your firm's perspective on activism, especially at the local level, and how that squares with business metrics like billable hours.
Oh, it's a great question. I think Jonathan was on the call that we had where we were talking about this issue of advocacy. I have to admit, I'm not operating at a local scale. I mean, truly not, because I'm so often on the road, I can't participate in my own community. In fact, it's kind of like not knowing plants as a landscape architect. I feel kind of terrible that I don't participate in community engagement processes around design and planning of my own neighborhood, because so often I'm in other neighborhoods actually hosting design and planning processes. But I do think that agency, through the work that we're doing, through the work that we're seeking, is really looking to find projects where these issues that we feel really strongly about can be demonstrated in practice. So the issues of resiliency and equity and diversity. And, you know, I think that what's so interesting to me about public work and the clients that I currently work with, so many of these civic entities are really, really interested in these issues. And so I think there is a business model that will support success for a practice like ours that wants to deal with them. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. And I do think that there's a real hunger for new ways of thinking about these problems in practice. And so for me, advocacy is really coming through the projects, the most important place that we as landscape architects can sort of put our best thinking in action. And so so really that's the place where advocacy happens. I'll also say, you know, I think Jonathan knows this just because I think he's active on social media as well, that I use every platform I can to get the word out about landscape architecture and the role that it plays in all of these wicked issues of equity and economic change and climate change. So I, you know, I tweet, I write, I blog, I Facebook, I Instagram. I'm never going to Snapchat. I'm just telling you right now, it's just my frontier. I will not cross. But I spend probably about half my time speaking about landscape architecture or writing about it or tweeting about it, because I think that as a professional, I also need to be an apostle for the work that we do. And so I see myself in that way. And my practice in that. Yeah.
All right. This time for one more question. So this will be our last question, and then we'll let you do a little wrap up and we'll go from there. So another question from Loretta. Since you mentioned you saw her live, what's your favorite song from Beyoncé's Lemonade album?
Oh, that's really tough. You know, because here's the thing about Beyoncé's Lemonade album is that it's a journey, you know? And so it's almost impossible to like one part of the journey better than the other. You know, first she's like angry and then she's sort of getting over it and then she's like empowered at the end. So I have to say, if I had to pick one, it's probably Freedom. Is it Freedom? Is that what it's called? One of the last songs that really is about kind of her breaking free and becoming, oh, that's the irony, right? New practice. You know, really owning her power is a really powerful thing. So, the you know, people can laugh about Beyonce all they want. And her sister, oh my God, Solange Knowles, was just like crazy. She's performed in, she's actually one of our, on our collaboration page, because she performed at a landscape that Brie worked on the master plan for at the Chinati Foundation. Oh. I mean, the two of them are just, they're just talking about race in this really, really powerful cultural platform. It's just, it's really extraordinary to me. When I saw Beyonce fill Gillette Stadium here in Boston, it was the first time I think I'd seen a woman headliner fill a 300,000 person venue, you know? And I just, that to me, that was just, I left sort of walking on a cloud. I was so excited for her and for our culture, for her.
Yeah. All right. Well, Gina, thank you so incredibly much for joining us again. It is always great to talk to you. We didn't even talk poker in this hour. It went so fast. That's my favorite topic with you.
I always love talking to you. Like, I keep making you do this with me over and over again.
All right.
Every Sunday.
All right. Fair enough.
I love talking to you.
Thank you. I know that our audience very much enjoys you, and we appreciate it. I want to give you the last couple minutes here just to open floor, talk about whatever you want, closing comments, words of encouragement, anything you want. It's, the floor is yours for a couple minutes here, and then we'll wrap up. All you.
Well, first, I would say thank you, Daniel, so much for this good work that you do. I think here I am talking about being an apostle for the profession, and you're not even a landscape architect, and you're out there doing, getting the good word out. So I really appreciate that. And thank all of you who are probably, I don't know, drafting and got headphones in at the office listening to me rant and rave about feminism and activism and practice. I really appreciate it. I'd say if you're able to come to Labash, I agree with Daniel. It's like a really extraordinary large gathering of students and across undergrad and graduate platforms. And I think this year's keynotes are myself and Ken Smith and Susanna Drake. So it's a really nice group of speakers. And then I'm sure there's like a ton of really interesting programming outside of that, but I'm really excited to see some of those talks myself. And I would just encourage everyone to know that that this is a really broad profession, and there's really a place for you in it. And I encourage you to come look at our website. Again, it's agencylp.com, just to see if the mission means anything to you. If you see anything in it that you want to share with me, please do so through the website or through Twitter or social media. But thank you so much, Daniel. It's always such a joy, and I love talking to the young people in our profession, and hopefully inspiring them to be confident that they're making the right choice by following this path.
Yes, you are very inspiring. So I think no need to worry about
that. As are you, sir. Thank you.
I'm sure that everyone learned a lot today and got excited about their future in the profession.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Ask LA.
Be sure to subscribe to the Ask LA podcast on iTunes, Google, or your podcast service of choice to catch every episode. For more information about the great work of the American Society of Landscape Architects, check out asla.org.